You are listening to The Dolphin Pod, brought to you by the Dolphin Communication Project and Tiny Cow Studios. Hi, I'm Justin Gregg, your host for The Dolphin Pod. In this week's episode, we will review breaking dolphin news from around the world, focus our science spotlight on dolphins and whales in the Middle Ages, and in our kids' science quickie, we'll discuss magnetite. And now,
Dolphin Pod News Highlights.
Dolphin chosen as official mascot of the 2014 Olympics in Sochi. The people of the southern Russian city of Sochi have chosen the dolphin as the official mascot of the 2014 Winter Olympics. The vote was held on March 2nd. Over 130 different ideas were submitted as possible mascots. Sochi was chosen to host the 2014 Olympics last year, and this will be the first time that Russia will host the Winter Olympics. Hayden Panettiere to be honored for her work raising awareness of dolphin conservation. Heroes actress Hayden Panettiere will receive the Weiler Prize at the upcoming Genesis Awards on March 29th, organized by the Humane Society of the United States. The director of the Humane Society stated that she's an inspiring example to her generation, using her compassion, courage, and celebrity to help animals in a very effective way. Panettiere made the news last year after being involved in a high-profile protest in the Japanese town of Taiji, where a large dolphin hunt takes place each year. Last year's winner of the Weiler Prize was Sir Paul McCartney. The age of modern scientific study of dolphins and whales and other animals probably started around the 18th century. Before that time period, what did the average person on the street know about whales and dolphins, and how did they come by this information? In today's Science Spotlight, we'll be speaking with Dr. Ranke de Vries, lecturer in Celtic Studies at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. Dr. de Vries studies ancient manuscripts from medieval periods. Dr. de Vries, before we get into the details about what people in the Middle Ages knew about whales and dolphins, can you give our listeners a quick overview as to when and what the Middle Ages were?
Sure. The Middle Ages is a term used for a certain period in history that is generally dated between the years 500 and 1500. Of course, these boundaries are just randomly set by later people. It's not that the year 499 was so different from the year 500 that there should be a new, you know, time period in history. But
so I'm assuming during this time period, this is before the printing press, people did not have access to books or other written material in order to find their information. Obviously, it didn't have Google.
No, not at all. People wouldn't have had access to things like newspapers or things like that. The only thing really that was produced in the form of anything written down were manuscripts, really, in Western Europe anyway. And they were produced in monasteries by monks.
So when you're studying what it was that people knew during the Middle Ages, you are looking at these manuscripts.
Yes. It's the only way really to, well, apart from archaeology, but it's the only way to, or they're the only written sources available to us. So that's what you have to look at if you want to study things from the Middle Ages. And later Middle Ages, it starts to become a little bit different because then you get the establishment of universities such as the Sorbonne in Paris, and then you get people who are paid to copy down books, because even then they didn't really have a printing press. So if you were a student at one of these universities, you would have to pay somebody to copy out all the books for you, which was, of course, as you can imagine, quite costly, as it all had to happen by hand.
So for these early manuscripts, who was writing them and why?
People in monasteries were writing the texts down, and as you can imagine, since this takes place, the writing down takes place in monasteries and scriptoria that were basically used for that purpose only, where monks were sitting there from dusk till dawn, really, writing out all these different texts. As you can imagine, a lot of the texts that they copied out were religious texts, and some of the most beautiful manuscripts that come out of the Middle Ages are For example, copies of the Bible or the Gospels, things like the Book of Kells that people might be familiar with. But also other information was copied out by people as was required.
So if we're trying to find information about whales and dolphins, trying to figure out what people in the Middle Ages knew about whales and dolphins, where would we look in these manuscripts?
There is a class of manuscripts, or a certain type of manuscripts, if you will, that are called bestiaries, and these were produced throughout Europe, especially profligately during the 12th and 13th centuries, around that time when these books started appearing in the vernacular. So you get French bestiaries and English bestiaries copied out. Originally, what these bestiaries are basically are catalogues of animals that are both real and fictitious. We know that these animals are fictitious. They were not fictitious to the people in the Middle Ages writing about them. Also things like stones and that kind of thing. And the purpose of these bestiaries was usually one of a moral example in since of course this was written out in monasteries, so certain Christian virtues or vices were attached to characteristics displayed by the animals that are described in these different bestiaries.
So the description of the animals, but I'm assuming that most monks, if they're working from dawn until dusk, don't have a lot of time to run around the fields of France or England and catalog all the different body parts of insects and things. So who is providing them with this information?
Well, bestiaries, this is where it gets really complicated. A long time before these 12th, 13th century bestiary things were written down, you had a book written in Greek called the Physiologus, which means the naturalist. And in the Physiologus, you find a catalogue or a description of a number of different animals without this Christian connotation. They don't know exactly when it was written or where, but it is known that there were Latin translations in the 4th centuries of this. And so this has been around for quite a long time. Now, as time goes by, other people write more information about different animals and, plants and stones and things like that. Especially Isidore of Seville is very well known for his encyclopedia that he's written, which was very influential throughout Europe. And then there are a number of other people, and you notice that in these bestiaries, at some point, all of this information is kind of amalgamated. So the bestiaries that you'll find in the 12th, 13th century are basically they have traces in them of the Physiologus, but they have been supplemented with information of all these different other sources that they have, that have sprung up in the meantime.
So these are copies of copies of copies, and then occasionally people add new things.
Yes, definitely.
So for whales and dolphins, for example, presumably there are fishermen or travelers or explorers who would run across a whale and dolphin, and then somehow this information would get back to the monk. And is that how they would then write their description?
I would assume that it would have to be something like that, that they would gather, originally they would gather information about this from eyewitness accounts of people who have supposedly seen these creatures. In the case of dolphins and whales, they would have, of course, because whales and dolphins were prevalent in the Atlantic Ocean. Especially before whaling. Also accounts of people who have seen animals like basilisks and unicorns and mermaids and things like that. If somebody would come by with an account of what they had seen, then and possibly if there are enough accounts of this, people would be inclined to adopt this into their bestiaries. Although, of course, the bestiaries around the 12th or 13th century are generally all, the subjects are pretty much all fixed. You don't really find a lot of extra elements coming in at that point.
So it could be that Joe Schmo sees a porpoise and then goes and tells a monk, and he describes it, but he also could say, I also saw a mermaid as well, and this is what it looks like, and the monk could write that down too.
Yes, yes, that's possible. That's possible, certainly in theory. And of course, people really did think that mermaids did exist. There are accounts where people have seen what they think they think that what happened was that people saw seals swimming away from boats, that in their posture and in their position or whatever reminded them of women, and that's possibly where the mermaid legend comes from. Although mermaids and sirens and creatures like that have been around since a long time. There's sirens in Homer, so.
So, and you're not talking about The Simpsons, obviously.
No. I'm talking about the Iliad and the Odyssey.
So, what, now that we get down to the nitty gritty, what mm-hmm. exactly did these bestiaries say about dolphins and whales, their property and what they look like, their behavior? What were they writing about?
Well, dolphins, there are basically two different kinds of dolphins that they write about. First of all, they say of dolphins that they're the fastest animal in the sea, and that they can leap over ships. Possibly small ones, maybe. They don't really mention this, but you know, it's. I don't think it has. It's just a giant schooner or whatever or a Viking boat that the sure. that the dolphin sure would be able to leap over it. But
they might be able to leap over a kayak.
Yeah, or a coracle, such as the case, such little boats in Ireland, for example. Mm. And they also are said to play in the swell and the waves, and if they do that, then they are said to be able to predict storms coming, and they also are sometimes said to congregate in groups and produce music or listen to music.
Mm.
So, and then there is a second type of dolphin that's described that is only lives in the River Nile in Egypt. That doesn't have a fin on its back, but serrated fins, and so it is. This is the way it catches its food. It catches its food by diving under a crocodile and then slicing open the crocodile's belly, but with his serrated fins, and thus getting his food. For whales, the descriptions of whales usually state that whales spend a lot of time. On the surface of the water, or at the surface of the water. And since they spend so much time at the surface of the water, things start clinging to the back, such as sand and things like that. And the effect of this is that sailors will sometimes mistake the whale or the backs of the whales for an island, and so they will land their boats on it and walk around on it and make camp and whatnot. But when they start a fire to cook their meal for the night, that's when the whale starts to protest and dives down and kills all the sailors because he takes them with him into the deep. And the descriptions of the whales sometimes vary. Sometimes it's only sand, but it gets as elaborate as trees growing on or forests growing on the backs of the whales.
Hmm. So obviously that's fanciful, but there is some truth, mm-hmm. of course, to the fact that sleeping whales do spend some time at the surface. There are observations of them hanging around in large groups and not moving very much.
Mm-hmm.
So there's truth. There's obviously truth behind some of these stories.
Definitely.
They're not pulled out of thin air.
No, definitely not, especially things like dolphins playing in waves and in the swell before storms, because that's... I hope I'm right in stating that dolphins quite like to play in rough waves and things like that. And in such an instance, they can be said to kind of predict a storm coming.
Sure.
So,
yeah. So your field is actually Celtic studies. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, could you tell us something more about what was written specifically in Celtic manuscripts, some of the manuscripts of Ireland and Wales and things, about whales and dolphins, if that's slightly different to other manuscripts?
Sure. In early Irish culture, I'm studying Irish in the Middle Ages mostly. In the Middle Ages, what they would have is they would catch porpoises. Porpoises, of course, being around estuaries and things like that, and sometimes in rivers, they would be caught for food. The term actually for a porpoise is a mukmara. Or mukvara, a sea pig.
Sea pig.
It can also be used for a dolphin, but dolphins are less likely to be to have been caught by Irish fishermen, especially near the shore, since they're less likely to come into rivers and things like that. There are accounts in Irish annalistic sources, so descriptions of what happened during each year, mm. that whales were beached, for example, and there are legal descriptions and legal procedures as to who was entitled to the whale. And what's kind of interesting is the fact that the church forbade all people from eating carrion, so dead animals, but whales were accepted from this rule, unless the whale had started to decompose already, then people couldn't eat it anymore. But apart from that, people could just eat whale meat, and possibly they were very excited about it. And for example, the king of the of a certain area where the whale was washed up could decide that all the whale was to be distributed among the people living there, or he could claim it for his own.
So if you found a dead deer in the hills, you weren't allowed to eat that. But if there's a giant minke whale washed up on the beach, you can grab your fork and you're good to go.
Well, it would have to be officially divided first, I suppose. So I don't know if there's anybody stealthily running up the beach with a fork, but officially it would have to be divided among the different people. The reason that the king could probably claim it for himself is that the fact that a whale washes up could be seen as good rulership. So as a sign that he's such a good king, a whale washes up, and so there's a lot of food all of a sudden.
So if you're doing a good job as a king, dead animals form around you.
Well, not only that, no, but whales could wash up, or there would be, say, a large abundance of fish caught and things like that. So very fertile land and things like that. But and they used several parts of the whale. They also used whalebone for different things, which in Irish is called whale's eyelash, because the baleen of the whale kind of looks like a human eyelash. The term for that is avrat bledhvil.
A giant eyelash, I suppose, but
yes.
Eyelash.
Yes. They are said to be used for breastwork of saddles and things like that, as very flexible material. And they could also be used for hoop making and distributed there in areas where there wasn't a lot of wood, so people could use it for that.
So this information, this isn't coming from bestiaries, I assume. This is from something like law texts?
Yeah, this is from legal texts. I'm actually... the information that I got out of a book by Fergus Kelly, who's quite a famous scholar, who has studied a lot of early Irish law. And this particular information about the porpoise and the whale can be found in a book called Early Irish Farming, which seems odd, of course, because it's not standard farming, if you will. But it describes a lot of different areas where people would... or ways for people to gather, food and things like that, and how they would come by their dietary requirements. I would recommend everybody read this book, but it might not have necessarily a lot to do with whales and dolphins.
Yeah, so as you were describing earlier, some of the animals that pop up in these bestiaries we now know are, of course, non-existent. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking, if you are a monk in the middle of France, you would be just as likely to see a whale or an elephant as you would be a unicorn or a basilisk. So they don't really have a way to know what's real and what's not real if people insist that they saw a basilisk.
No, exactly. They get their works, and they copy these this information of animals out of books that they thought were very authoritative. So they had no reason to really question what was in these manuscripts that they copied from. Plus, if you don't travel, and if you don't have the occasion to travel, which of course most people wouldn't have had, especially far travel or overseas travel, that would have been really difficult. How would you know that a certain animal didn't exist? I mean, now you can have an account on television, of, for example, the small elephants that are found in, I don't know where exactly it was.
Oh, right, the small the pygmy Java elephants. Or some island.
Yeah, where they also found the humans that they call the human hobbits or something like that. But even now, if you don't go there yourself, would you really know that they existed or not? You'd have to trust television for that. Mm. You know, of course, you would trust science too. If there's a scientific article exactly detailing things like that, you would believe it. But a sensationalist newspaper could come up with something, and you wouldn't necessarily know if it's true.
In the Middle Ages, you wouldn't have had that level of inquiry.
Not at all.
What about, I know that there was evidence for unicorns, scientific evidence, because people would actually present a horn to someone else and sell unicorn horns. Can you explain what was going on there?
Well, yes. Of course, if somebody comes up to you and says, unicorns exist because here I have a horn and it comes from a unicorn, then who are you to question it if you've never been to any place where you would have found a unicorn? And unicorn horns, the legend surrounding a unicorn was that it was one of the most difficult animals to trap and catch. And it could only be caught if you put a young maiden in its path, or a young virgin, because he would submit to her and put his head in her lap, and then hunters could get it and get at it. But the horn of the unicorn was said to have properties that could neutralize poison. So that would, you know, obviously it would be a very, very desirable object for people who wouldn't want to be poisoned, which I assume is most everybody. And so, of course, these horns had to be produced from somewhere. And usually, there are different animals that they whose horns that they used for this. But one of the major ones was the tusk or the tooth of a narwhal. And of course, the tooth of a narwhal is kind of twisted in shape, in the same kind of shape that you would see in a, say, a modern drawing of a unicorn. That's often what you would find. So a narwhal would be caught somewhere, and the tooth would be cut off and then sold for a lot of money to some rich merchant somewhere, who would then grind it up into a powder or put it on the table or whatever, in order to prevent his being poisoned.
So these pictures, I'm thinking of the unicorn pictures, but I've seen some of the pictures of whales and dolphins from these manuscripts, and they don't look anything like whales and dolphins. So how can it be that the you know, the behavioral descriptions, although a bit fanciful, obviously are based on something, but these drawings are just downright silly?
Well, you have to imagine that these drawings were usually made by people in the monasteries. Usually what would happen with manuscripts is that you'd have one person writing down the text, possibly one person adding red letters in the text, and then somebody who would be responsible for illuminations. And illuminations are drawings in the manuscript to illustrate a certain point. This can occur in lots of different manuscripts, but they're very often they are found in things like bestiaries, and you'll find drawings of the different animals. And of course, the person who is drawing this can either go with what they know or how they perceive a whale or dolphin to be, or they can copy it from a manuscript that they had before or that they have before them. But if the person who is drawing this has never seen a whale or dolphin, how would you think, if you just had to go on the description of the dolphin, how would you know what it would look like? You would think that it was a giant fish swimming in the ocean somewhere. And in the case of the River Nile dolphin, it would be a giant fish with lots of serrated fins on its back. So it's not so strange that it looks completely different from what we know that a dolphin actually looks like.
So essentially, they just sort of make it up based on what they think it might look like,
based on general belief, and depending on where you live, of course. I would assume that you would be more likely to get accurate depictions of dolphins in a place where the person would actually have had the occasion to see a dolphin, rather than a landlocked area somewhere. So
great. Well, where are some sources online or otherwise that people who are interested in seeing some of these pictures, or maybe reading some of the descriptions of whales and dolphins from the Middle Ages, where might they be able to look?
Well, there are a number of different websites. I'll give you some links that you can put up on the website of the Dolphin Communication Project.
Okay.
But one of them that I found quite interesting to look at is a facsimile or a version of the Aberdeen Bestiary. So you can actually see, you know, the actual manuscript with the pictures and the text and a translation of the text, which could be interesting for people to read through. So that's one. And then there's a website called the Medieval Bestiary, which gives some very short descriptions of the different terms used for different animals, and also different classical sources that the information was known from, and pictures. So I'll give you the link to that.
Well, I'll definitely put those links up there, so people can check these manuscripts out.
Yep.
Great. Well, I appreciate you joining us today, taking your time out of the day to talk to us.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
And now, a science quickie for kids.
Have you ever heard of magnetite? Magnetite is a naturally occurring mineral that reacts to magnetic fields. scientists believe that many animals may have small amounts of magnetite in their brains, allowing them to sense magnetic fields produced by the Earth. Animals like bats and birds, especially pigeons, are thought to navigate large distances without using any clues as to where they are, other than the presence and shape of magnetic fields, which they can sense using the magnetite in their brains. Whales and dolphins, too, are thought to have small amounts of magnetite in their brains, allowing them to navigate enormous distances across the oceans. Scientists also suspect that some whales and dolphins may strand when the Earth's magnetic fields fluctuate beyond their normal positions. Navigating by the magnetic fields that they have used their entire lives, whales and dolphins may think they're in the open ocean, but in reality, they're dangerously close to shore. It would be a lot like trying to navigate your living room with a blindfold on after someone has moved around all of your furniture. Even humans have a small amount of magnetite in our brains, so the next time you trip over your shoelaces, you can blame it on fluctuating magnetic fields. We had quite a few correct answers to last week's quiz, and our winner, chosen at random, is Rebecca Frost, who correctly stated that it was a trick question. Dolphins do not have bones in their dorsal fins, only fibrous tissue. Now for this week's quiz. What's the main difference between the blowhole of a bottlenose dolphin and the blowhole of a humpback whale? Think you know the answer? Surf on over to thedolphinpod.com and click on Dolphin Quiz. Leave your answer in the comments section. Winners will be randomly chosen from the correct answers and will be announced on next week's show. That's it for this week's edition of The Dolphin Pod. Thanks for tuning in. If you would like more information about the stories from this week's episode, check out thedolphinpod.com. If you've got questions or comments about this week's podcast, please contact us through the website. Why not consider signing up for the Dolphin Communication Project's online community? You'll get access to a forum where you can discuss the Dolphin Pod with other listeners. The DCP website offers a chance to adopt one of our dolphins from the Bahamas, as well as learn more about volunteer, internship, and ecotour opportunities. Don't forget to join us next week for more dolphin science news and information. And remember, the Dolphin Pod is only a click away.